on The Voice of America.
Elation and chaos.
There is no room for looking back. We are looking into the future.
Kenyans are bracing for a legal battle as William Ruto is declared the winner of a tight presidential election. But Raila Odinga is rejecting the outcome.
Kenya faces a grave legal and political crisis.
We'll have reporting from VOA's Vincent McCauley in Nairobi, and we'll discuss what is next for the East African nation. Also, a defining moment for Angola as voters head to the polls on August 24th. With a battered economy and younger electorate, will President João Lourenço win a second term? And how much of a threat is UNITA and its new leader, Adalberto Costa Jr.? VOA correspondent Myra de la Salette gauges the mood for us in Luanda. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. This week, we are continuing our coverage of that presidential election in Kenya, where the results of the vote are now in dispute. The country's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission declared Deputy President William Ruto the winner of the election with 50.49% of the vote. But Raila Odinga, who's running for the fifth time, finished second with 48.85% of the vote. In a television address, Odinga rejected the results. And now the country faces a legal battle. VOA's Vincent McCauley is in Nairobi for us with this report.
At a media briefing in Nairobi, Azimio coalition presidential candidate Raila Odinga said his coalition totally rejects the election results, but at the same time urged his supporters to maintain peace.
But suffice it to note that we will be pursuing all constitutional and legal options available to us. We will do so because we regard the many flaws in the elections and the wrongs committed by the IEBC as fatal to the process and the outcome announced by Mr. Chebukati.
On the campaign trail, both Odinga and Ruto had pledged to deal with any disputes in court rather than on the streets. Any challenge must be made within 7 days to the Supreme Court, which then has 14 days to issue a ruling. If it orders an annulment, a new vote must be held within 60 days. Moments before Mr. Odinga spoke, four of Kenya's seven election commissioners held a press conference and said they stood by their decision a day earlier to disown the results of the August 9th presidential election. Speaking for the group, Electoral Commission Deputy Chairperson Juliana Cherera said the results that gave current Deputy President William Ruto a thin victory over Raila Odinga were erroneously aggregated.
We state categorically that the results of the presidential election held in August 9, 2022, declared and announced by Mr. Wafula Chebukati on August 15, 2022, belonged to himself and do not represent the declaration and announcement by Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. The commission has to process the results before they are declared and announced by the chairperson.
Kenya was calm on Tuesday, and more people could be seen going about their businesses after days of suspense and anxiety waiting for the IEBC to announce the winner of the presidential race. In Nairobi, some shops remained shuttered on Tuesday due to uncertainty. I'm in Kibra, one of the biggest slums in Nairobi, and it's considered the stronghold of Mr. Raila Odinga, the presidential candidate for the Azimio coalition. Now, it's a day after the election results were announced by the chairman, Mr. Wafula Chebukati, and as all might have noticed, Mr. Raila Odinga boycotted that ceremony along with some of the commissioners of the IEBC who claimed they cannot take ownership of that result. So we came around here to hear from the people of Kibra and find out what they plan to do next. And a majority of them are telling us they're waiting to hear from Mr. Raila Odinga himself.
According to Kenyan constitution, if they're releasing the result, at least four commissioners should comply or should accept the result. And you can see the four of them walked away. So he remained with three. That really shows that the election, the result was not unfair. So what we should do is that first, we're waiting for what Raila will say. Secondly, if he won't talk even right now, we as a young task, we'll file the petition in the Supreme Court.
Obadha rejected the characterization of Odinga supporters as perennial protesters.
Raila's people are not chaotic. We're just optimistic on we know what we want. And that's why sometimes we feel that if you can't get it peacefully, sometimes we try to use force.
Here's another Odinga supporter.
The only thing I think will follow next is Azimio will go to court and the court will give us the way forward. Yeah.
Others just want to see people move on with their lives.
Just tell my fellow Kenyans for us all to unite together and then rebuild our country, mostly our economy, and all we're passing through, and let's unite all and become one.
We're supposed to have a peace because even if you do anything, it cannot help us. We need our children to go back to school.
No poll outcome has gone uncontested in Kenya since 2002. Now, the aftermath of the largely peaceful vote will be keenly watched as a test of democratic maturity in the East African powerhouse, where previous elections have been marred by claims of rigging and violence.
Well, Vincent Macquarie reporting there for us from Kenya. Now, for more insight and analysis on the situation in Kenya, I am joined by Vincent Macquarie in the capital of Nairobi, and David Mondas with us too. He's a political science professor at City University of New York, and he joins us from the beautiful coastal city of Mombasa in southeastern Kenya. Gentlemen, welcome and thank you so much for joining me. Vincent, I'm going to start with you here. What is the mood in the country right now, both in the Ruto and in the Odinga camps? Your reporting says things are calm, but is an uneasy calm, you know, the kind that happens before a storm?
You don't get the sense that there's going to be a storm, but suddenly there is a certain cloud of uncertainty, you know, especially for those of Odinga supporters who are hoping against all hopes that a legal challenge will become successful and in some way hopefully lead to Mr. Raila Odinga being declared the president, because they have cherished that hope. And when they went through the process, they strongly believe that he's going to be president. Remember, the polls towards the election time were indicating that he was way ahead, at least by 6 points or so. And after the election was conducted, his team confidently told the supporters that we have done our math. Everything is in line. We are winning. We have it. In fact, I was at one of the meetings of the Azimio people. The leaders were meeting the newly elected legislators and governors, and they were saying, we're just waiting for the announcement to confirm that Mr. Raila Odinga is the president. So people were looking to that day with so much confidence. So you can imagine how devastating it was. Some of the people I spoke to, actually, that were not on tape, said they're really hurting and they are waiting. But they are determined to maintain the peace. Where there was some initial reaction, of course, especially when the announcement was made. But generally, there is peace. And you cannot describe it necessarily as the peace before the storm, but it's a sense of uncertainty, a feeling of a sadness. In fact, some of them just don't even want to talk about it. But on the other side, the Ruto supporters are kind of confident, they're jubilating, they're celebrating in places, and life is getting back to normal. That's an indication. Business is kind of coming back, not totally as it would be in other months, but you can say in other parts of the country, life is just going on as always.
Professor David Monda, please explain for people who might not have insight into Kenya's elections and sort of these legal avenues that candidates can pursue. The last time this was decided by the courts, things didn't really work out too well for Raila Odinga. What are his best legal options here, and what makes him think that he can prevail in the courts this time?
Yes. So for our viewers, Kenyans elect 350 members of parliament, and that 290 of those are directly elected by the voters. 47 of those are women representatives. 12 of those are nominated, and then you have one speaker for a total number of 350 members in the House of Representatives. And then, of course, you have the Senate, and you have senators from each of the 47 counties. The issue here is with the presidential race, and I think this is where it becomes a really dicey legal challenge, because the country is going to be faced with this situation that if the presidential election is declared invalid, does that then invalidate the races for the governors, all the other races, for members of parliament, for members of the Senate, and so on and so forth? Heidi, might I also add that right here in Mombasa, where I am, Mombasa County, and in Kakamega County, which are two of the 47 counties we had, the elections were bungled. So we didn't have elections for governor, for the specific seat of governor and governor of Mombasa and Kakamega. So I think this whole legal complication with the presidency, I think, is also shrouded with other complications that, other levels in terms of the elections that were not had. But I think Raila Odinga essentially faces a pretty daunting task to show evidentiary or evidence, right, which is a high threshold, that the elections had significant flaws that would ultimately invalidate the final outcome. A lot of the challenges we hear, at least as of present, is, declarations against how the chairman declared the result. But at this point, it's not clear that the Azimio faction or Odinga's faction actually has evidence particular to the numbers of the voters, and to show that those numbers are flawed in terms of the number of votes he got, about 6.9 million, versus those that Ruto got, which were over 7 million. And I think that is where the struggle will be in the court.
Vincent, just as David mentioned right now where he is, the election was bungled. I mean, how credible are these types of allegations in this situation? How credible are Odinga's allegations that the vote was rigged?
You know, actually, if you look at, and Monda made a point there that there were other elections. To be fair, most of those elections for governors, for members of parliament and senators and members of the county assemblies have not been disputed. At least those have been accepted in most of them. I mean, there might be a legal challenge there. So those who have been members of parliament elect, the senators and others, are actually duly elected and accepted. And just a little bit, I think I may just mention that I think going by the history of the rulings that affected the presidential race, especially 2017, the presidential race annulment, if it was to happen, does not affect those of the members of parliament and senators, because it's kind of, that is done kind of sort of locally, and it's declared by the returning officer. The presidential race is declared by the chairman of the IEBC, so it stands alone. And this electoral commissioners who disavowed this result are not actually questioning the entire process of the election that was conducted across the country. They're questioning a certain aspect of the presidential election and the very end part of it, and they're challenging how the chairman handled that very last moment when they take the final numbers, tabulate them, compare the two forms. There is form 34A, 34B. You look at them and take those numbers and agree as a commission that they're fine. Then you produce a third form called 34C, where now you sign off and say this is the final presidential race. They are questioning a certain part of that and saying the chairman acted unilaterally. So when it comes to the other side, the questioning that the Azimio has been making in terms of rigging, they They have their own argument, and nobody so far can tell you for sure that we don't know, but they say they know. They know that there was a manipulation of the election at some point. They say they have evidence that there was some kind of interference with the final process. Now, they have not explicitly put it out there, but they're saying they're looking at all the options they have legally and constitutionally. So you can only say that we are going to get to hear more when this gets to the Supreme Court, and then we'll kind of get to understand what evidence they have. Mr. Odinga was not willing to elaborate, really. But of course, we know that they're going to, if you go by what the commissioners who resented was saying, is that if indeed the chairman acted inappropriately in the way he announced it, then the declaration invalidates the presidential the announcement, or that it invalidates that declaration of Mr. Ruto as being president. And if that was been null and void, then it means you go back to where there is no declared president. I think that is what they're going to try and argue in court as one of the issues. So if they can invalidate the declaration itself, then it means you go back to square one and make a determination whether you're going to do a proper recount or forensic kind of examination, or you need to have a redo of that election.
Vincent, say it doesn't go all the way to redo and the court make a ruling on this either way. Remember, Raila Odinga and William Ruto both said they would accept the outcome of this election. They said that on the campaign trail. Now, of course, Raila Odinga has not accepted the results. And I asked you this before. Will his supporters accept the result should it not go in their favour, but then comes from the court? Kenya's judiciary is fiercely independent, well known for that. Will the people accept a court ruling?
So here's one thing I have to say. First, the candidates always say, I will accept the results, but it's with a caveat, if they are free, fair, and credible. So then they say, yes, I promised I'll accept the results, but then we have determined that there were flaws in the system. Now, when it comes to the supporters, if I speak about Raila Odinga supporters always act on the cue that is given by Mr. Raila Odinga. Is very influential. Now, if he tells them, it's okay, it hasn't gone our way, but you know what? We still have control of parliament. We are so influential. We have all this number of governors and all this number of senators. Don't worry, everything will be okay. There will be no problem, because whatever Raila says to his supporters, they tend to really listen to him. What I don't know is how the reaction will be if, let's say, this election will be invalidated, and then Mr. Ruto is, for some reason, it's announced that he's not a president, that he didn't win this election, or it's not clear. It's hard to tell how those who have already accepted him as the president, who have been jubilating, will react, because reversing this, I think, is more painful than having to want to hope that you get it. Reversing that is very, very painful. It's very hard to imagine what the reaction will be. But all that will depend on the leadership. I think whatever the leaders will tell their supporters, that's what's going to happen.
And of course, justice and fairness is often in the eye of the beholder. David Monda, we have not heard yet from President Uhuru Kenyatta, who was, of course, a supporter of Raila Odinga and did not support his deputy president in this. And now, his deputy president is in a similar situation he had found himself in the past. Tell us, is it a good move for him to just be quiet right now and let things play out?
I think it's a good thing for him to be quiet and let things play out, because essentially he's at the twilight of his, his leadership. And this really needs to be seen to be a judicial process and not a political one, as much as the politics intertwined with the legalities of the outcome. And a little bit to add to what Vincent had said, I think there's a big challenge. For example, when you think about Mombasa, that we didn't have a governor's election here, or Kakamega, just because of, you know, some of the challenges with the processing of the paperwork for the election. When you add that to the uncertainty of the presidential election, I think it really creates, you know, broader challenges about the legitimacy of whoever is going to win this election. So, for example, if Raila Odinga's petition at the Supreme Court fails, you know, this challenge and Raila's rejection of Ruto's winning of this election, I think really creates a legitimacy challenge for the Ruto government. Also, Heidi, remembering that the Azimio faction, which is Raila's faction, has a majority in the House of Representatives, and Ruto's faction has a slight majority in the Senate as we speak. So even aside from the legislative and the politics of the judicial process, I think it'll be a big struggle in the parliament, in the legislature, as these two factions struggle sort of in terms of trying to define their policy. But at this point, you know, it's really about the judicial process, and it's a good thing that, you know, the current president has stood aside, because it shouldn't appear that he's taking sides or trying to influence a judicial decision, because he was obviously in favor of Raila Odinga, who at this point appears to have lost the election.
David, I've got a final question for you. We don't have a lot of time, but we did talk previously about the maturity, that there's a test for the maturity of Kenya's democracy, excuse me. And of course, nobody wants to see how the sausage is made. Democracy is messy. What does the current state of things say to you about the maturity of Kenya's democracy? What are we looking at here? A maturing democracy or not?
I think definitely a maturing democracy. I think from all the previous elections I've seen, this has been one of the most transparent. You know, we've had a record number of women governors elected to the governorship, increasing number of women elected as members of parliament. I think it's a growing pain in terms of improving the process. And I think ultimately we as Kenyans really need to do a better job about ensuring that the commission is a people of integrity, that they ultimately speak in one voice, and that, you know, some of the challenges that we've been having in terms of tallying, but specifically in terms of the divisions within the IEBC, which is the commissioners, this is an ongoing problem that reared its ugly face in this election, but it's also been a problem in 2017 and previous elections. So I think vetting commissioners and ensuring the faith and trust of Kenyans in the integrity of our institutions is a growing challenge, but I definitely see this as teething pains in a growing democracy, obviously, and one of the leading democracies in, you know, the East and Central African region.
And we will continue watching developments in Kenya very closely. Professor, thank you so much. David Monda is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He joins us from the Kenyan city of Mombasa. And Vincent McCorry, who has been doing all that fantastic reporting for us in Kenya. He's the managing editor for TV in VOA's English to Africa news service. Gentlemen, thank you so much to you both. After the break, we turn our attention to Southern Africa, to another crucial election. Angolans prepare to go to the polls next week. Will President João Lourenço win a second term? And we also look if UNITA will break the ruling MPLA's decades-long hold on power. We've got our guest standing by. We'll tackle that next.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
go.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Wednesday, August 24th, is set to be a defining day for Angola. Voters will go to the polls to choose a new president and parliament. And while there are eight parties on the ballot, this election is largely a race between two longtime political foes and the men at the top of their ticket. President João Lourenço of the ruling Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, or MPLA, and Adalberto Costa Jr., who leads the main opposition National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, or UNITA. Now, the MPLA and UNITA fought each other in a brutal civil war that ended in 2002. Now their candidates will face off at the ballot box in what is likely to be Angola's most competitive election yet. Angola's ruling MPLA in the final stretches of campaigning, as President João Lourenço seeks to serve a second term. 5 years ago, he came into office declaring war on corruption, nepotism, impunity, and promising to reform Angola's battered economy. The MPLA has had an unbroken hold on power since Angola gained independence from Portugal in 1975. The party won just over 61% of the vote in the 2017 general election. The opposition UNITA took about 27% of the vote. Lourenço is the hand-picked successor of the late former president José Eduardo dos Santos, who ruled Angola for 38 years. Lourenço now faces a challenge from UNITA's charismatic new leader Adalberto Costa Jr. Popular amongst Angola's fast-growing urban youth, Costa Jr. is a fierce critic of the ruling party's reforms. President Lourenço is being praised abroad for his anti-corruption drive, which he launched shortly after taking office. The government says it has recovered billions of dollars in stolen assets both at home and overseas, as Lourenço went after high-ranking civil servants, ministers, party officials, and members of former President dos Santos' family. Critics, however, say the president's corruption crackdown has been selective and politically motivated, and that his efforts to reform and open up the economy have fallen short. Many Angolans are struggling to put food on the table amid rising inflation, the crippling economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the country's worst drought in 40 years. If the stakes aren't high enough, distrust appears to be growing among voters. A survey by the Pan-African Research Network Afrobarometer shows one in five Angolans trusts the country's National Electoral Commission. With an estimated 14 million people registered to vote, many are bracing for a tight race in what could be one of the most consequential elections in the Southern African nation's history. Now, VOA's Myra de la Salette is in the Angolan capital of Luanda, where she's been gauging the mood of the voters ahead of next week's election.
Angola is holding general elections on August 24th. Eight parties are running. This time around, it feels a bit different, though, because for the first time, the leading parties are actually tied. The main party and the main opposition party are very close on this run, on the intention of vote. People feel a bit more nervous also. They share with me that there's a bit of fear of the results after the 24th. Some old memories of war have been rising because they say, they mention that the threats between both parties bring that. But they also say that whoever wins this election, what they want from them, that what they want them to focus on, the priorities, are health and education. They believe if the next government focuses on that, their life will be better. The only thing that they want is better conditions, a better life based on good health and good education. I'm Maya de la Salette, covering the election in Angola for Voice of America.
And that is Myra de la Salette from VOA's Portuguese News Service with that report for us. And joining me now to discuss the political playing field and what is at stake in Angola's upcoming election, I'm joined by political analyst Marissa Lorenzo. She joins us via Skype from Johannesburg, South Africa. And in Maputo, Mozambique, is Borges Namire. He's a researcher with the Institute for Security Studies. Borges and Marissa, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me here on Straight Talk Africa. Marissa, I'm going to start with you. What is at stake for President João Lourenço in this cycle and the ruling MPLA?
Thanks. It's great to be on the show once again. So there's quite a lot at stake here. Lourenço has presided over years of economic recession. He's presided throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and he really wants a second term to prove that the MPLA is really the best party to lead the country. But you need to once a chance to show that it can govern and to show that it can actually tackle the problems that the urban youth have been speaking about, such as problems like a lack of infrastructure development and high unemployment.
Borges, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being highly successful, how would you rate President João Lourenço's performance during his first term in office?
Thank you. I think the expectation was so high when he assumed the power, when he took the power 5 years ago. And now maybe his performance is at five.
Well, that is not, that's neither here or there, we would say. Marissa, the economy is obviously going to play a big role and top of mind for many voters, as it is in many elections. What is the shape of the Angolan economy today? We know that, you know, the economy is in trouble, as many economies are right now. But this economy needs diversification. João Lourenço said he would do that. It's heavily fueled by oil. Oil represents 90% of Angola's exports. Lourenço said he was going to open up the economy, that he was going to tackle corruption and lift Angolans out of extreme poverty. But unemployment has not dropped below 30% in many years. So which of the promises that Lourenço made in 2017 did he keep, and which of these has he broken?
Well, I think that we can understand his reform agenda is divided into two main parts, and those are the political reforms and economic reforms. So when we look at the economic reform front, he's done very well to manage Angola's debt load, which reached about 120% of GDP in 2020. The economy has finally exited a six-year-long recession. He's done very well throughout the IMF lending program. He has managed to engage with Angola's largest creditor, which is China. And it's actually gotten to the point where now Angola's debt has dropped below 100% of GDP. Some of this is also due to the strengthened oil price as a result of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. But as a whole, his administration has been very committed to fiscal prudence, to reducing wasteful expenditure, and that has really paid off very well. But unfortunately, that's had a broader impact, you know, so it's helped broad stability, at least until debt repayments become due next year. But it hasn't actually trickled down. So it hasn't resulted in increased jobs or increased investment. And this is why we still have very high unemployment. Then when we look at the second tier, at political reform, this is where Lourenço has taken less action. So, for example, he promised to host local elections during his first term in office, and that didn't happen. He promised to make society more open for civil society organizations and NGOs and journalists. And what we've really seen coming out of the past few years is that it's still quite a repressive environment in which to operate. So I think he's got quite a mixed record. I think he's done very well in terms of the broader economy, but definitely there's a lot of room for improvement.
Borges, I've read you say that this election is, quote, an uneven playing field. Please tell us, why do you say this?
Well, it's because the government, MPLA, and the President Lourenço himself, they have control over the oil state resource from state-owned media. We can look to the state TV, for example, TPA. It just published favorable news to MPLA, to President Lourenço himself. And if it publishes about you, need to criticize it. But also, MPLA is a dominant party in Angola. So they have control over the state. They have control over the society. They even have control over the courts, over the electoral bodies. So people, as you did show in a very brief poll, opinion poll, only one Angolan out of five trust in electoral bodies. So that's the reality in Angola. So by the end of the day, MPLA and the government itself, President João Lourenço, they can decide how and how much votes they need. So the result that will be declared from the polls is likely not going to be the real result reflecting what the people will do.
Marissa, the opposition candidate Adalberto Costa Jr. is also portraying himself as a change agent. He's looking to capitalize on frustration with the government and the state of things in the country. He wants a sea change. Tell us a little bit more about Costa Jr., the man himself, his policies, and what are his weaknesses and his strengths going into this election?
So what's really interesting about him is that, you know, he's one of the most charismatic leaders that we've ever seen in Angola's political landscape. And he's really managed to resonate with the urban youth and managed to articulate some of the issues that they face in society today and tap into that frustration that they have with the ruling government. He's actually lived abroad quite a lot, and he's managed to raise the profile of UNITA, especially in Portugal, but also in countries like Italy. He's been a member of the party for a very, very long time. And I think that since he became leader in 2019, what's been most interesting about him is that he's tried to take the party through a slow modernization. He wants to reach out to other opposition candidates. We've seen it, you know, with the United Patriotic Front that he spearheaded. He's someone, you know, that is able to bring a lot of people through to campaign rallies. He engages with people on social media. He's trying to offer a kind of more direct line to the presidency and to not make politics so stiff and so formal.
And of course, he does have appeal amongst the younger population. Borges, by President Lourenço's own admission, the youth will be a decisive voting bloc in this election. Now, if you, of course, go by the numbers alone, it's a no-brainer. More than two-thirds of Angola's population is under the age of 30. But as we've seen in elections in other parts of the continent, getting those young people to show up at the polls on election day is almost always a very, very challenging task. Are Angola's young people motivated and energized enough to show up at the polls, and will their vote be as decisive as we think?
Okay. The turnout in Angolan election has always been high, higher compared to other regional countries like Mozambique, Zimbabwe, for example. And I think for this election, the turnout will be higher, because people are motivated. The fact that Adalberto Costa Jr. is so charismatic and is bringing new ideas and is bringing a real possibility of winning the election, it will motivate people from both sides, both UNITA supporters and MPLA supporters, to go to the poll. Because the UNITA, they see, okay, finally we have a leader. A real leader, who they didn't have in the last years since the death of Savimbi. And then from the MPLA side also, they think, okay, we see that the unit is now unified, is now stronger, and then we want to challenge them. So I think the turnout in the next election will be maybe the highest, compared to the 1992.
Marissa, this election does come just weeks after the death of Angola's longtime leader and liberation hero, José Eduardo dos Santos. How much of a role will nostalgia about what dos Santos did for the country, what he represented for the continent, how much will that play into which way people will vote in this cycle?
So the death of dos Santos is, of course, quite recent, but I don't think that his memory will play a large role in this election. And I think that's because since coming into office, Lourenço has actually taken great care to remove the image of dos Santos away from Angolan public life. So we saw him rename buildings, rename streets, sort of take away that memory making, you know, that put dos Santos at the center of the state. Then, of course, you know, we did see a lot of back and forth about where the funeral of dos Santos would be held, and we did see some unpleasantness there between the MPLA and DeSantis family. But that lasted about a week or 10 days, and then after that, it's really quietened down. I think that the sort of role that DeSantis has played in the memory of the Godin people has definitely diminished, and that they, you know, that people are really deciding between Lorenzo and Costa Jr.
Borges, what is your take on this? What role will nostalgia play here?
I think it will play an important role because there's a part of MPLA supporters who think that President Lorenzo did not treat with dignity the president, which might be a high faction of MPLA, might want to vote against President João Lorenzo. But again, I think that role will be limited because, as we know, in Angola, we have a single ballot paper, meaning that if one wants to vote MPLA, we'll have to vote in President João Lorenzo at the same time. So if we had the situation like we had in the first election in Angola with separate ballot papers, we could see that MPLA would get much votes than President João Lorenzo. But at this time, I think people who don't agree with President João Lorenzo and the way he treated President José Eduardo dos Santos will even vote in him because they want to vote in MPLA. So I think that is the situation.
Marissa, in terms of support, how does the MPLA fare, especially compared to other liberation movements in the region? SWAPO in Namibia, for example, ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, and the ANC in South Africa. This seems to be a feature of Southern African politics where you still have liberation movements in power, but a younger electorate who do not share the same memory of the glory days of those movements. How does MPLA fare on this score?
It's definitely a factor, this growing urban youth population, you know, that doesn't just rely on kind of post-colonial loyalties. And like you've mentioned, ZANU-PF, SWAPO, the ANC, they've all kind of gone through various phases where we could see, you know, that urban voters are tired of their socioeconomic conditions. And I think that actually the MPLA is going through a similar thing, because if we look at how you need to perform, especially in the 2017 elections, we saw that it made quite significant inroads into the capital, Luanda. And, you know, this is where a lot of Angola's urban youth are concentrated. Angola is very, very highly urbanized by developing economy standards. And I think that that is a real sign, you know, that the MPLA can no longer simply rely on post-war loyalties, and that it is facing a larger challenge than ever before from the urban youth. And it's really this frustration from these types of voters that UNITA is managing to tap into. We could see the signs from 2017, and I think they're even stronger now in this campaign period.
We're going to take a short break here. Thanks, Marissa. On the other side of the break, we'll continue our discussion. We'll be right back.
Home is more than just shelter, a private place to raise children and a private space to process your inner feelings and thoughts. Regardless of where you live, access to affordable housing is always a leading conversation in the society. This week, we are taking a closer look at how accessible affordable housing is in Africa and how women are breaking barriers in the real estate market. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
Welcome back. We're talking about the upcoming elections in Angola, set for August 24th. And what is at stake for the Southern African nation as they go to the polls? I'm joined here by Marissa Lorenzo and Borges Namire. Borges, earlier I asked Marissa how the MPLA fares compared to other liberation movements on the continent in terms of declining support or not. What is your take on that?
I think MPLA is following the same path as the other movements in the region. As we can see, younger people who are going to vote this time, when they were born, Angola was already independent and the civil war was already over. So the speech to blame UNITA, for example, to blame opposition for all the poverty in Angola, for all the, you know, like the civil war, people who have been born in 90, in 2000, they don't care about that. So what they want is development, what they want is employment, what they want is the government fulfilling the promises. So I think MPLA and other movements in the region, ANC, Frelimo in Mozambique, Chama Chama Pinduzi in Tanzania, all of them are facing the same problem. Should they want to continue being relevant, they will need to implement very important reforms. So talking about the history, about the glory history of liberation, is no longer enough for the youth now.
Yes, indeed, challenging to sell the idea of memory of earlier events to an audience that does not have or share those memories. The MPLA, the government, should I say, has been on an international voter drive, which they kickstarted in January. This means the 450,000 members of the Angolan diaspora who are eligible to vote, both on the continent and in other parts of the world, including here in the United States, will be able to cast their vote. This is not a feature that's very prominent in many other elections in other African countries. Certainly something very interesting and an initiative of João Lourenço's himself. Marissa, is this going to come back to boost the party or bite the party?
To be honest, I don't think it's going to have a major impact. I think it's part of a tactic on the part of Lourenço because he hasn't delivered things like local elections. It looks good, you know, to the international community that, you know, now he's allowing the diaspora to vote for the first time. But I don't know that we're going to see an enthusiastic voter turnout. I think potentially a lot of people that are not in Angola that are voting fraud might feel quite disillusioned with the electoral system and the kind of MPLA's dominance of it. So I don't think it would come back to bite him, but I also don't think, you know, it's this great reformed move. I think it sets him apart from his predecessor, from Dos Santos, because it's not something that Dos Santos ever did. But I don't think it was necessarily a sign of the true reform on the political front.
Borges, why would Lourenço take this gamble? I mean, from the research that you have done over the years, does a diaspora necessarily vote as a bloc, or how do they tend to vote? What can you tell us?
Well, first to say that the Angolan diaspora is just 0.15% of the electoral population. So are not significant. But this is important because this is the very first time that the Angolan diaspora will vote to elect their president, to elect their leaders. So President João Lourenço might use that as a you know, a political game to say, look, for the first time, you can vote, even living in diaspora. But they don't add much more in terms of the figures. They're just 0.15% of the voting population. Secondly, I think that this propaganda in diaspora is not aimed to the Angolan. This is aimed to the international community, to the investors, to the donors community. So I think that message is not directed to the Angolan diaspora, but to the international community, but at the same time to Angolan in Angola in domestic politics. So I think this is just a strategy, and I think the vote from diaspora is not going to make any difference.
Marissa, speaking of the international community, how are Lourenço and Costa Jr. regarded on the international stage? What kind of important relationships do they have, and how are they perceived?
Well, if we look at Lourenço first, and then, of course, the broader government under that umbrella, what Angola has done during Lourenço's first term is it's really improved its ties with the West, so particularly with the US, but also with the EU. So, you know, we've had your old partners like France and Portugal, but we've also seen it forge better relations with countries like Germany, for example, which will be quite critical if Angola is to explore other opportunities within its energy sector besides oil. Then if you look at Costa Junior as well, he's also made a lot of effort abroad, again in Portugal, where you know where he does have a lot of experience, he does have a lot of support. And then, of course, in the US as well, again, engaging with the West. So both of them, I think, are seen quite favorably abroad. I think, though, when it comes to bilateral relations, and especially when it comes to investors, investors don't always like uncertainty. And for them, they are happy with the fact that Lorenzo has, under his economic reforms, he has opened up the economy a bit. Foreign direct investment has still not reached the levels that it was at before 2014. It's still quite suppressed. It's still quite low. But some of the reforms that he has made, especially in the diamond mining sector, those have been quite welcomed by investors. And we've seen some multinational communities come in. And, you know, from that point of view, when you're looking at the broader political environment, most of the time investors would prefer the kind of overall sentiment towards investment and with the economy to stay the same.
Borges, Lorenzo is, of course, he does come across as quite the breath of fresh air on the international stage. And, of course, he's probably going to be touting continuity to the international community here. But what are the chances for, or how does the international community perceive Costa Junior? Would him coming into office, or him potentially winning, would that have negative perceptions or negative repercussions for Angola internationally?
Well, I think at this level, the challenge to the candidate of UNITA, Adalberto Costa Jr., is higher than João Lourenço, simply because the international community, and we're talking about the international community, we must consider their interest. What does the international community needs in Angola? They need to do business. They need to have a reliable partner. So they already know the MPLA government. You know, Angola has several international big companies investing in Angola. So those companies want to see stability. So for them to keep their things as they are now, it's good for them. So I think President, the UNITA candidate, he must do more to try to tell international community that he's not going to break the business. He's not going to not throw out the contract, so he will respect the contract that have been signed by MPLA, by João Lourenço, by José Eduardo dos Santos. He's already doing that, but I think in this level, João Lourenço is in advantage.
Marissa and Borges, I want you both, and I'll start with you, Marissa, to tell me what's going to be the most important things that you're going to be looking at coming out of the election. Yes, there will be a winner. And of course, we're going to look at the margin of victory as well. How important is that? And what are the other things that you're going to be looking for?
Definitely looking at voter turnout, because if there is a high abstention rate, which, you know, as Bob just said, we don't expect. But if there is a high abstention rate, that definitely gives UNITA the advantage. You know, so what I think the MPLA local governors are going to be doing in this last week before the election is really trying to rally up their supporters in their key strongholds to make sure that that doesn't happen. So definitely looking at voter turnout. Also looking at the possibilities of episodes of periodic unrest in the major cities, particularly in Luanda. This is sort of the lead up to the election and on voting day. Looking for reports of any issues with transparency, anything, you know, that civil society might raise. Civil society is going to be trying to do their kind of own electoral observer missions at polling stations, trying to see if there's any police intimidation that happens of that. The government has warned civil society and the opposition that they're not allowed to do a parallel vote. So again, you know, we might just see some scuffles break out. I'm not expecting huge unrest, but it's something to keep in mind. And then I think in the days afterwards, when we're waiting for the results to be announced and when there are results, if the MPLA wins, which I expect it to, UNITA will almost definitely challenge the results. And looking at how the courts handle that, which would be the Constitutional Court or the Supreme Court, they do have an overlapping mandate. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out, and then, of course, how the population reacts to a likely MPLA victory.
Borges, what is your take? We've seen the elections in Kenya. We're still waiting to see what happens next there. What will you be looking for in Angola's election? And do you think this is going to be something that will be done with very quickly? Or do you foresee any complications after the vote and during counting process?
Well, the playing field is already uneven for this election. So what I'm looking for is how the state institution, the court, the electoral body are going to be honest in this election. How are they going to handle the election honestly? So it means transparency, it means free election and fair. So that's what I'm looking for. And the most important is how Angolan will react to the election. So I'm really afraid that we might see a post-electoral violence in Angola, and I hope that it is not going to happen, because that is not good for Angola. That's not good for the continent. But that is what I'm foreseeing. Violence, post-electoral violence, that is what I fear, and that is not wanted in Angola and in the region.
I have time for one more question, and Borges, I'm going to put that question to you. What does the new president have to tackle first? We have an economy in crisis. We have distrust among voters. What is going to be his most important task at hand?
First of all, civil rights. I think that Angola needs to stop to crack down the civil rights. So it means the next president of Angola needs to open to the freedom of expression, freedom of press, allowing independent media to develop in Angola, but also allowing civil society to grow and do their work freely. Now Angola is classified as a non-free country by several international index. So the next president needs to make Angola a free country in civic rights, but also in terms of economy. I think the next president must stop to look to who belongs which political party. So they must stop to look. Imagine if Lorenzo wins again. They must stop to only give employment and good condition to the MPLA members. So even to those who don't hold the MPLA membership card, they need to have the opportunity in Angola. So I think that is the most important. Shall next president fail on that, in 5 years' time, we'll be here discussing the same problem as we're discussing now.
Marissa, very briefly, what do you think should be top of the agenda for the next president?
I think that definitely getting economic reforms to trickle down. I think promising more or greater infrastructure investment that is just not just aimed at big ticket projects. Yes, we've had hospitals being built. We've had new refineries. This is all very important. But, you know, what about roads? What about housing? Things like that. And then I agree with Borges as well that, you know, we do need to see a greater effort towards democratic reform in Angola. You know, Angola is only nominally a democracy. We have seen civil society and NGOs speak about the repressive environment. We do see them self-censor quite a lot. And that's something that I think would be important to change to kind of appease the local population that reform is still on the cards and that Lorenzo has not totally abandoned the promises that he campaigned on in 2017.
Marissa, Lorenzo and Borges Namire, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for your insights and for your time. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to all my guests who joined me, and a big thank you to all our affiliates who are airing this show across the African continent. I appreciate you, our audience, for giving me your time on television, radio and online. Thank you for always watching and for always listening. Take good care. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.